planetaudio.org.nz.
Mercy Spirituality Centre presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Centre in Ipsum. We're a centre for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a guest to join me for a conversation on different topics. Today, I am playing a repeat of an interview that I recorded last year with Professor Thomas O'Loughlin. On Thursday, the 23rd of July, 2020, Brother Kieran Finn will give a presentation on the topic, The Eucharist in the Four Gospels. Brother Kieran will talk from the perspective of a Bible scholar. Therefore, I thought it would be a good idea to repeat my interview with Professor Thomas O'Loughlin, who is an ordained priest and professor of historical theology at the University of Nottingham. And in this following interview, he will talk about the Eucharist from an historical and liturgical perspective. Let's hear from Tom O'Loughlin and his insights into Didache and the Eucharist. Here it goes.
Tom O'Loughlin is originally from Dublin, Ireland, and is an ordained priest and professor of historical theology at the University of Nottingham. He is currently visiting New Zealand, where he has been giving presentations. He's still giving presentations on different topics, especially in the area of liturgy. I went to one of his talks at the Christ the King Church in Owairaka, and it was wonderful to hear the insights on the Eucharist and the history of the Holy Mass. Tom, you mentioned a few times the Didache. Can you tell us more about it? What is that?
The word Didache literally means the training. It's the Greek word for training. And you have to imagine, we think of the early church as having things like the letters of Paul, and then later having documents like the Gospels. But quite apart from these, the letters of Paul were occasional things. They were occasioned by particular needs. And the Gospels are the written down recordings of gospelers who were coming to give a performance, an overview of the whole vision of Christian faith. But the people in the communities, in the local churches scattered all across the Mediterranean world, they needed something that would be their training. And the training began as something very simple, and it kept developing. And when it was still in the simple stage in the first and second centuries, it was something that every disciple of Jesus actually learned off by heart. Now, we knew that this existed because we had lots of references. They had learnt the training, and they had read the training, and they had copied the training. And we knew, but everyone said, well, what was it like? And people said, well, it probably included the Lord's Prayer. Yeah, well, so much. That's, you don't have to be brilliant to make that guess. It probably included something like some sort of variant on the Ten Commandments. Well, again, you wouldn't have to be very bright to make that guess. But then in 1873, a brilliant young Greek monk was working in a library in Constantinople, now Istanbul, cataloguing books. And the funny thing about this particular librarian was he had already spent a couple of years in Germany, and indeed he had there met all of the great editors. So as he was going through the book, his mind was alerted to be looking out for unusual things, and he discovered a copy of the Didache, a copy of the Didache that reflects the way the Didache was used in Greek around 80 AD. And this is the most precious document we have from the Christians from the first century that's not in the New Testament. And it's even more precious because all of the documents in the New Testament were special documents. This is the ordinary document. This gives us an insight into what was actually happening in a local church at the time. And so, for instance, it's got a very detailed list of do's and don'ts. And then we thought, well, that's very unusual. And then we found in 1947, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, we thought, Now we have a copy in Aramaic of the same thing that we find in a Christian document in Greek, and we realize that an awful lot of the moral practice that the Christians were putting forward to these Greek converts to the religion of Jesus, wasn't yet called Christianity, in the middle of the first century, they're actually using a document that was being used for training little Jewish boys and girls back in Palestine, which we had also lost, and we only found with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the other interesting thing was that it presented Christian life as two ways. It begins with the mythical vision that is the end of the book of Deuteronomy, that Moses is offering the people two ways, a way of life and a way of death. And he says, if you go the way of death, bad things. If you go the way of life, you come into the whole dynamic life of God. So this was the interesting. The Didache was not just do's and don'ts, but it was a whole vision of Christian life as entering a community, and a community on a pilgrim path. And so, for instance, the major development in Christian theology in the 20th century of seeing Christian life as a road, as a pilgrimage, as a discipleship, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, all of these ideas received a major boost from the discovery of the Didache in the late 19th century. And then, of course, it had other things. Yes, they were right. The guess was right. There is a text of the Lord's Prayer in the standard Greek reciting form that people would know it from the Gospel of Matthew. But there's a section on baptism, how to baptize, what baptism means. There's a big section on the Eucharist, and indeed it gives you a text of how you can celebrate a Eucharist at any meal.
So how big is that?
It takes 22 minutes to read.
22 minutes?
Yes.
So it should be in every Christian household?
But lots of things should be in every Christian household. The interesting thing is it also has loads of rules on how to deal with visitors to a church. So, for instance, if a missionary comes from another church, such as someone preaching a gospel, well, give them food for 3 days. If they stay for a fortnight, they may be taking advantage of you. They should be getting on the road. So there's also there's lots of stuff that every Christian needs to know about how to live, how to do, how to pray. But there's also a very practical section, I find the practical section the most interesting of all. And it takes 22 minutes because over the years I've got students to read it in Greek, and I've collected the average timings, and some will be faster and some will be slower, and the average is 22 minutes. And actually it was learnt off by heart.
So it's certainly also available in English now.
Oh yes, it's available. It's been available in English since 1885. There you are. And I've done a translation of it about 10 years ago, so you can use my translation. And also, it's somewhere free on the web, my translation. You can go and find it.
Thank you very much.
So that's the Didache.
That's the Didache. Didache. Nice Greek word. And do you call your translation then the teachings or the teachings?
No, I think I call it just the Didache. I'm very unoriginal. I just call it the Didache. It's best not to use the word teaching, because Didache does mean teaching in Greek, but that's a very dictionary usage, and it presupposes someone sitting in a room at a blackboard. The normal usage of Didache in Greek actually is the trainings, and it's more like you should think of it more like a cookbook than an instruction manual. Yes, it's more like the Didache was treated by the early Christians in the same way that we all know that you have to know basic cooking.
Yeah. And Well, you're listening, if you have just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/Muffin Talk or visit our website or Facebook page at Tengaka Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. My visitor today is Tom O'Loughlin, and we've just talked about the Didache. Tom, we have, I showed you that our program for this year, the Mercy Spirituality Center, is under the theme gratitude. The year of gratitude, how does that fit in the vision of the Catholic Church, in your opinion?
Well, gratitude is at the very center of the response of the Christian to God. We think of the whole of creation, and therefore the whole of human life, and therefore my own existence, as something which comes from God as a pure gift. Hence the old phrase, all is grace. In other words, God had no need to create, and so the very fact that we're here is his gift. And so when we become conscious of ourselves, we become aware of our dependence. And in becoming aware of our dependence, we become aware of the loving nature of God in creating us, and the response to that is gratitude. So gratitude is the fundamental attitude of the aware human being to the mystery of creation. And this is something that is then becomes absolutely central to Jewish prayer. And it becomes central, that the whole notion of the temple in Judaism is that evening and morning, the people of Israel, being the ones who are aware of God as creator, render back thanks and praise. So the temple is fundamentally, I don't want to use the word mechanism, but it's the way that the people of Israel express who they are. They are grateful. And for Jesus, it's a gratefulness to the Father. I thank thee, Father. I thank thee. I give thee praise. I bless thee. And so all these phrases like praise, bless, thank, they're all actually synonyms in Jewish language at the time of Jesus, and they become synonyms in Christian language. And there's a very simple way to see that. In the Gospel of Mark, we have the free gift of a feeding to people out in the middle of nowhere. And at the beginning, Jesus blesses the Father. So he makes the people aware of this gratitude to the Father. And then a few chapters on, there's another feeding, different numbers. I think it's 3,000 and 5,000. I can't remember, but that's not important. What Mark wants you to remember is, in the first time he says, I bless you, Father, which is thanking. And in the second time he says, I thank you, Father, for all of this. So again, it's this awareness of gratitude. And then, of course, at the meal of the Last Supper, we see Jesus blessing and thanking. So the two words are coming together. So blessing and thanking and praising, expressions of gratitude, this is the basic language of Christian prayer. And of course, the most perfect expression of that is the word we use for our central religious service.
For the Eucharist.
The Eucharist, which is this Eucharist. To be Eucharistic is to be thankful, to engage in Eucharist. Eucharist is an activity. It's the activity of expressing our gratitude to God. And, you know, we use this phrase, being celebrating of the Eucharist is the center and summit of the Christian life. So gratitude is right in there at the core of Christian living.
I think that the Anglicans also call part of the Eucharist the great thank you.
Yes, well, that's just a way of saying the great Eucharistic prayer, because the word Eucharistic prayer just sounds like a bit of jargon. And people wonder, lots of people say, oh, well, we're using Eucharistic prayer too today. And they wonder, well, it's the great prayer of thanksgiving. So that we Christians have to be very careful of our language. We have to avoid words that are really just slang. The word mass is slang. It comes from the last words, go away. That's what it literally means. The better word is Eucharist, the need to express gratitude. And we also have to be aware that sometimes we use words, oh, this is Eucharistic, and we don't know what it means. It is the prayer of thanksgiving.
And before Vatican II, the Eucharistic celebration was also in Latin. Mm-hmm. So people were not aware necessarily that it was a celebration of thank you. They might not even have heard the priest, because if the priest turns the back to the people, they
and
wouldn't
much
have heard
of it, it was in silence, and much of it was said in a very low voice. And of course it was said without microphones. And there was a very strict rule that if you were to use a low voice, because there might be several priests saying several masses on different altars, and so they mustn't interrupt one another. So it's one of the major breakthroughs of the latter part of the 20th century for Catholics is that we have become far more aware of the centrality of the Eucharist and what the Eucharist actually means.
And with the translation, did that also become difficult? Because there are lots of problems with translations even today.
One of the practical problems within the Catholic Church at the moment is the fact that there are some people who think that translation should ape the language in which it was originally cast, which was Latin. And of course, there are phrases you can say in one language that you can't say in another language. And the crucial thing is to have a very easy language that allows people to express the gratitude that is in their hearts in a common language. And for instance, your first language is German.
Yes.
Well, so you know that you would say in German, you make a lecture. Mm-hmm. Whereas we give lectures and we make coffee, we don't do coffee. And there's a lovely story. The key to translating anything is caught by a friend of mine who taught English in Dublin. Now, it's very important to remember it's in Dublin, because he said to the people in the class who are learning English, when the best way is practice your English on the bus. And they said, well, what should we talk about to the people next year? Well, they said, well, talk about the weather. That's what all Dublin people do. And so he thought, this is great, they'll all go off. Next day, he said, well, how did you get on talking about the bus? I'm talking to the people, how'd you get on the bus talking about the weather? And one girl burst out in tears and says, Dublin people are not very nice. I started to talk about the weather and the man said back to me, don't talk to me. And of course, if you grow up in Dublin, what that means is there's no need to say it. I totally agree with you. It's an expression. So we all have to realise that there are expressions in Latin which are meaningless in English. And there are expressions in English which are meaningless to even English speakers in a different place. And the challenge for the Catholic Church is to evolve easy-flowing translations, some of which will suit New Zealand, some of which will suit Australia, some of which will suit many English-speaking places. And that is a big problem you put your finger on, Beata.
And maybe in the Vatican, some people don't realize how different the expressions in the English language are in different parts of the world.
Well, bureaucrats in general tend to be very linguistically challenged, which is one of the reasons why filling out forms is usually so difficult.
Yeah. And what else did come with Vatican II, something that we have to be grateful for?
Well, I think the
so
first thing...
at least
thing,
we can understand
I,
something.
I think the first thing we have to be thankful to Vatican II for is for giving us an accessible liturgy that allows us to realise that every human being who is a Christian is a celebrant of liturgy. We are all celebrants of liturgy. It's not something we can outsource to a specialist group. But I think the other great thing we have to be thankful to Vatican II for is its vision of the church. The church is not just an organization. The church is the people of God who, as they go about their daily lives, are seeking to understand what God is calling them to do and actually to move forward. And so, for instance, before Vatican II, very few people spoke about religious awareness, religious understanding, a religious comprehension of what's going on in their own lives. What we talk about is spirituality. But one of the great fruits of Vatican II is that realizing that the Spirit of God is present in every human being, and the Spirit of God is especially present in every baptized person, we have the challenge of trying to discover our own spirituality and then seeing how that relates to the spirituality of others. And that can be the spirituality of other Christians, other monotheists such as Jews and Muslims, and indeed the spirituality of the world in which we live. And that's that open vision, which is that Christians look outwards rather than just treat themselves as if they were hidden behind a little wall, which is always a tendency in religions. Religions tend to be very good at gluing people together, but they also tend to be good at doing them inside little fortresses. So Vatican II reminded the Catholic Church, and to a certain extent reminded all Christians, that we mustn't think of religion as a fortress. We must think of it as a stepping off point by which we make God present in the world.
And then we go back to Ite Missa Est, the Mass is over.
Go ye out. It is over. You are sent out.
And the other difference was, like, when you had the Mass before Vatican II, you had people sometimes came to maybe only the homily, or they came only for the Eucharist. But now with the old rule. Awareness of Eucharist and the Word being both important.
Yes, and of course, though, because it was seen as something that was detached from them, it was just an external obligation. Terribly precious, but just an obligation. The old rule was you had to be there before the end of the Gospel and you could leave before communion time. So it was sort of a minimal engagement. And one of the things that Vatican II did was to try and present the Eucharist is a celebration of a people. And it is a people gathering, becoming aware of who they are, listening to their memories, seeing how, which is the readings, then seeing how their memories should be affecting their understanding today, the homily, expressing an awareness of who they are and their needs to God, the prayer of the faithful, and then, no matter what, they are thankful, and they express their thankfulness to the Father in Christ Jesus in the sharing of a meal and sharing a loaf which bonds them together, and sharing a cup which gives them which is an expression of their common destiny.
And you mentioned that you were supposed to be from that time to that time at Mass. Who said that? Was it the Vatican who told people when you had to be at Mass, or was it the priest? Or
it was just accepted that was the minimum. That was the minimum acceptable participation, but it wasn't participation. It was mere presence. It was very interesting the words that people used. They didn't say we're going to celebrate Mass. Only the presbyter celebrated Mass. They didn't say we're going to gather. No, they said we were going to hear Mass or attend Mass or just go to Mass. And it was this idea that you were, as long as you were there, it wasn't the idea that you actually had to take part. But of course, gratitude, as your center knows, is an activity. You have to behave thankfully, express thankfulness. So the Eucharist, the thanksgiving, has to express gratitude, and it has to be a behavior of gratitude.
And you have to take it out of the church and spread this good feeling.
It has to begin in the gathering, wherever it is, whether it's in a church building or wherever it is, and then it has to spread outwards into every part. And that's why that phrase of the Vatican Council, it doesn't say there's Mass and the world or the Eucharist and something else. It says the Eucharist is the centre, and things spread out from a centre. Things are linked to a centre, and it's also a summit. But of course, if it's a summit, the summit only becomes the summit because even the foothills all the way out to the... what we're doing there is a very precise expression of something that should be happening in the whole of life.
Yeah, so we have a lot to be thankful for, and I thank you for having come to the studio.
Thank you
for coming from Ireland or from Nottingham and giving the lectures here in Auckland in different occasions. And I'm sure that people... they really appreciate your presentations, and they're so full of energy. And it's a nice way to learn something about the history of Mass, because Mass and culture are so closely connected, aren't they?
Yes. The liturgy is one of the ways that human beings stay together as groups, and therefore the Eucharist has been one of the ways that Christians have stayed together as groups, and it's taken place in all sorts of strange places and in all sorts of situations, but liturgy expresses who we are, and that identity is of course a thankful people.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And what is happening in our last days at the Mercy Spirituality Center? As I mentioned, on Thursday the 23rd of July from 10:30 to 12:30, Brother Kieran Finn will come for our last Muffin meeting at the Mercy Spirituality Center. The topic will be the Eucharist and the Four Gospels. On Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July, Margaret Bowater will facilitate an introduction into dream work. On Saturday the 25th July, from 10 o'clock in the morning to 3:30 in the afternoon, Sister Kathleen Rushton will facilitate a workshop with the title The Presence of the Spirit in the Gospel According to John. And our last event will be on Wednesday the 29th of July from 7 to 9 p.m. in the evening. This is an interfaith event at the center and will be organized in cooperation with members of the Auckland Interfaith Council. For more information, please check out our website at www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz, our Facebook page, or send us an email at info@mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you.